Next to the Lord's Prayer, Psalm 23 is one of the most well-known and beloved passages in the Bible. To learn more about it, join me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. Psalm 23 holds a special place in my heart, so I'll start with a personal story before we begin examining it. Almost 20 years ago, I was hospitalized for 5.5 weeks due to a very high-risk pregnancy with lots of complications. I was bedridden on very heavy medications, and for my first couple of weeks, I was in a small labor and delivery room about the size of a walk-in closet, a large walk-in closet with no windows, because typically women only stayed in those rooms for 12 hours, maybe 24 hours at the most. At night, I would lie awake and be unable to sleep, sometimes hearing people entering late at night into the labor and delivery area. And sometimes women were crying in pain, and sometimes they were crying in desperation because they were in labor much too soon. While lying awake and hearing these anguished cries and going through my own physical and mental life and death challenges, Psalm 23 was my refuge many, many nights. Living literally, it felt like in the valley of the shadow of death was too real, and this psalm was a deep source of comfort. So I want to take time today to explore this timeless psalm that still speaks to us across the centuries. There are two main metaphors used in Psalm 23. Verses 1 through 4 portray the activities of a shepherd, and the last two verses are descriptive of a gracious host and guest. Both metaphors emphasize God's great care. Psalm 23 was written by King David, and the fact that he spent his boyhood being a shepherd means that he knew the role intimately, its challenges and its dangers, and it was a natural way to glorify God's role as the great shepherd based on his own experience. We don't know when David wrote this psalm, but there's a good chance that it was done later in life when he was already the king of Israel. As a quick aside, I want to mention that the metaphor of a shepherd in the ancient Near East was also applied to kings. Kings were expected to have the qualities of a good shepherd because they are primarily responsible for provision and protection. We're going to take a few minutes and examine the psalm verse by verse. Most of the words in the original Hebrew are very straightforward, but for a few of them, there can be a range of meaning, so I'll share those. And I am not a Hebrew scholar, but I have studied Hebrew for a number of years, and I did have to translate this psalm for one of my doctoral courses. So I'm going to share the King James Version with you, as well as my very literal personal translation that in some cases actually follows the word order of the original Hebrew more closely. There are just six verses, and we're going to examine each one in detail. Verse 1 says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." My translation reads, "Yahweh is my shepherd, I am not lacking." Notice that God's name is first. That is not normal word order for Hebrew, so when his name is first, that is done for emphasis. Also, Yahweh is known by the Hebrew people as his covenantal name, and it's appropriate for David to use the special covenant name for the Lord because David had a special covenant relationship with God, and David calls him my shepherd, showing that there is a very personal relationship. This isn't some impersonal theological poem. David's psalm reflects a deep and heartfelt relationship with God. The Hebrew word translated as want can refer to being in need, to be without, or to lack. It can imply a present experience that is ongoing. So when added with not, it can mean I am not lacking and I will continue to not be lacking. In the phrase I shall not want, I also want to point out that the word not in Hebrew is lo. It is a very common word in Hebrew that appears a lot in the Old Testament. Now, there is another Hebrew word that can be used to say no or not, but that word is used for a simple prohibition. But lo, when put with an imperfect verb, which is what we have in this verse, is a very strong prohibition. It is the same format used in the Ten Commandments. The Hebrew for the Ten Commandments reads literally like, not you shall have other gods, not you shall make, not you shall bow down, not you shall take. And here in Psalm 23, we have not I shall want, or not I am lacking. So it's not some lackadaisical statement saying, oh, I won't want anything. It's a strong, emphatic statement saying, I do not and I will not be lacking. David is saying that God is such an amazing shepherd that he lacks nothing and will continue to lack nothing. David speaks of the Lord as his shepherd, emphasizing that the Lord's sheep have inexhaustible resources available to them. Now, let me pause here to say that theologically, this verse can be difficult for some people because life can be hard. People who live for God can be in pain, sometimes materially poor, and sometimes suffer persecution. So this is not a promise to live a life of comfort or material prosperity. What does it mean to not be in want or to not be lacking? Now, this could be a topic for a whole episode by itself, but one scholar I read said it this way, and it made sense to me, that David is asserting that we will not lack anything that we need within the framework of God's will for our lives. We will not lack anything that we need within the framework of God's will for our lives. In other words, there is nothing that I will lack as a child of God that will be necessary for my spiritual welfare and growth. The Good Shepherd knows precisely what his sheep need, and he provides it. Verse 2 in the King James Version says, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. My translation reads, in green pastures he causes me to lie. To restful waters he guides me. The verb to lie down is in the causative form, so the King James translates it as makes me to lie down, and I translated it as causes me to lie down. Other English translators or translations say, lets me lie down. Another difference is the Hebrew word for beside, which has a broad range of meaning, the original word does. And beside is the most common translation in this particular psalm. But since the verb is to lead, then the preposition to can make it sound a little more fluid. Another difference is that the King James uses the word still to describe the water, and I use restful because rest is actually the most common way that the original Hebrew word is translated, and sometimes the idea of still water can give the connotation of it being stagnant, and it's not. It's just peaceful or restful waters. It is a resting place that is peaceful and tranquil. I also like the overall poetic parallelism of the original Hebrew, which I try to capture in my translation by following the Hebrew word order. In green pastures, he causes me to lie down. To restful waters, he guides me. The poetic rhythm of the Hebrew is very pretty. Now, remember the topography of Israel. During the summer in the wilderness, there was oppressive heat and sometimes blowing sand. Shepherds would take their flocks across rocky hills and sand dunes to reach their destination. Imagine how the sheep must have felt revived by finishing the long journey and reaching the destination with trees for shade, lush grass for grazing, and water to quench their thirst. Only a knowledgeable and experienced shepherd would know where to find this abundance and know how hard he could push his sheep to get there. In the psalm, David describes a rich, lush pasture land, but we should be careful assuming that spiritual rest only comes when we are in comfortable circumstances. For us, true rest is being where God wants us to be. Some people are bloated because they've partaken of the Lord's blessings and haven't exercised enough in sharing their blessings or sharing the gospel. And some people are spiritually anemic because even though God has provided pastures for them, they look elsewhere for their nourishment and they feed on other things. Verse 3 says, "He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake." My translation follows the word order of the Hebrew a little more closely and says, "My soul he restores. On right paths he leads me for the sake of his name." The word translated as righteousness in the King James Version can have an ethical quality to it, and I do like that. But it can also have a more direct and literal meaning, especially when talking about a shepherd leading the flock to his provisions, in which case the word could be translated as the right, meaning that the shepherd is leading his flock on the right or correct paths. The journey takes a toll. Sheep have to travel sometimes long distances through rugged terrain, and a good shepherd provides whatever is necessary to help weary and weak sheep. They need to be properly fed and rested to make the journey from one place to another. And once they've received that much needed rest, as described in verse 2, the weary soul is revived, like we see in verse 3. And the safety of the flock is paramount. After the sheep regain their strength to continue on their journey to the next destination, the shepherd has to guide them so they reach it safely. They'll be destroyed if they wander down the wrong path. And the Hebrew word translated as lead in this verse is different than in verse 2. Here it is stronger and more definitive. The word is commonly used to describe God's leadership of his people, Israel. Sheep are not capable of distinguishing between trails that lead to safety and those that lead to danger or death. They will frequently follow paths that look safe to travel, but they have limited vision and can't see around curves, so the shepherd has to be in complete control. And there are some sheep that wander time and time again, and the shepherd helps them and rescues them each time with tender patience and appropriate discipline, because every sheep matters to the shepherd. Verse 4 in the King James Version says, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me." My translation says, "Even when I walk in the valley of deep darkness, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." Now, this is an interesting verse. It's what we would call a conditional sentence or an if-then clause. The psalmist is saying, "If I walk through the valley, then..." But the Hebrew can actually be a little stronger. It's not so much if I walk through the valley, but when I walk through the valley. Even though the shepherd is leading me on the right paths, there will be valleys to go through. But God will be there. God never promised immunity from sorrow, but he did offer the grace to endure and overcome it. And what is this valley like? The phrase shadow of death is actually only one word in Hebrew, and the King James consistently translates it in all 18 occurrences in the Bible as shadow of death. But other translations can include black gloom, the deep, deep shadow, thick darkness, and deep darkness. It is a place of extreme danger, often associated with death or the threat of it. It conveys a sense of profound gloom and peril, like being in the shadow cast by death itself. So it is a place of terrifying vulnerability in which divine protection is needed, and it is dangerous for a lamb to downplay or worse, ignore the dangers and deceptions that evil can bring. And David says that he didn't fear evil because God was with him. David courageously fought the lion and the bear to protect his sheep that were entrusted to him by his father, because the Lord, his shepherd, was always with him. A shepherd willingly risks his life and even gives his life for his sheep, whether it be wild animals or thieves that are attacking. Now, a hireling may let the sheep get attacked because he cares about his own life more, but not a shepherd who values and loves his sheep. Jesus declared his love for us, and as our great shepherd, he cannot be overwhelmed by any enemy, so he willingly laid down his life for us. David mentions the rod and the staff. The Hebrew word translated as rod may designate not only the shepherd's rod, but a teacher's staff, a ruler's scepter, and a weapon. The word translated as staff is generally considered to be a longer stick, up to 6 feet in length. It serves as an aid in climbing over rocks, in chastising loitering sheep and fighting goats, and the elderly can use it for support. It could also be used to check the crevices and caves in order to chase out snakes or scorpions that could endanger the flock. The rod and staff bring comfort because they are the symbols of a well-prepared shepherd, and they provide him with a clear identity as the shepherd. The rod provides protection because it can be used to ward off any animals which might attack, and the staff is for prodding necessary to keep the flock together and on the right path. It can also be used to steady the shepherd as he climbs the sides of dangerous mountains to rescue lost or injured sheep. So the rod and the staff represent protection and guidance, and the shepherd will rescue the sheep if necessary. Now, as we move into verses 5 and 6, we have a new metaphor. Most scholars recognize that verse 5 introduces a new image, a host and his guest. Some commentators want to completely change the setting to the temple or a palace, but the description actually fits well with a shepherd who has been in the fields and is now back at his tent. The figure of the shepherd can be maintained throughout the entire psalm, but there is a shift from the sheep to the guest. Verses 1 through 4 have talked about the nature and the extent of the shepherd's protection, and now verse 5 focuses on the benefits of his protection. The traveler needs protection and provision, just like the sheep. Verse 5 says, "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over." My translation says, "You arrange a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows." So there are no major differences in these two versions. In the context of a shepherd caring for his guest at his tent, David's reference to preparing a table was actually a common expression for furnishing a meal. The same type of expression is used in Proverbs 9, verse 2. Furnishing a table was about providing food. It wasn't about the actual furniture involved. David was expressing God's provision as a gracious host. Hospitality in the ancient Near East was a highly esteemed virtue. Moving to the enemies, in this case, would not be wild animals like the sheep would fear, but it could have been thieves or others who wanted to harm the traveler. But the traveler is safe in the shepherd's company, no enemies get through the patrol set up by the shepherd. Similarly, Jesus has defeated the enemy of our souls, and we can gather at his table in freedom and peace. And according to John 14, he has prepared a future place for us. Anointing the head with oil refers to the perfumed oils, which were common provisions of a gracious host. Now, it was considered the sincerest form of hospitality. And this is just like God, because he goes beyond giving us provision at his table for all of our needs, but he also anoints our head with oil. This is grace. And even more, we have a well-filled cup. Literally, it would refer to the vessel for drinking liquids at the dinner. But other psalms refer to the Lord as our choice portion and cup. So David also is referring to a spiritual refreshing. The cup of every believer is filled abundantly. So think about verse 5. The host has carefully prepared for all of the needs of his guest. Through his power, he has defeated all surrounding enemies, so there is peace. And he goes beyond the minimal requirements for gracious hospitality by providing perfumed oil. And then the cup is filled to the brim and overflowing with the promise of more if it is needed. Moving to verse 6, it says, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." My translation says, "Only goodness and mercy will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will abide in the house of Yahweh for the length of my days." I'm going to quote a few lines from a scholar who sums it up this way. Up to this point in the psalm, the shepherd has taken us through deep ravines and dark valleys while faithfully protecting his sheep from wild animals and thieves. As helpless sheep, we have followed him and found the way sure. When it appeared that a barren world would deprive us of life-sustaining food, he fed us. When our bones ached with weariness from difficult journeys, he faithfully provided resting places, rich with pasture and a good supply of water. We have also followed our perfect shepherd, not as sheep, but as guests to his tent, only to realize even greater blessing and full provision. In spite of surrounding turmoil, we eat in peace at a table with an endless supply of blessings. Anointed and with a full cup, we rejoice in the goodness of our divine host. David's simple shepherd song now builds into a symphonic crescendo of theological richness. David probably recognized that his final years would have pain and disappointment, but he was emphasizing the assurance of God's continued blessing and care in spite of all circumstances. The word surely is in an emphatic position. The word translated as follow really has the sense of pursuing or chasing. It is often used in scripture in a battle context with troops pursuing each other. Goodness and mercy will follow good men. And the word translated as mercy can also refer to covenant loyalty, loving kindness, and steadfast love. It is a rich Hebrew word. So there was a promise of temporal blessing, but also eternal blessing. David's great desire was to dwell in the presence of the Lord forever. And he said it with certainty. And for us, Jesus is preparing a place for us so that where he is, we might be also. And notice that verse 6 uses the name of Yahweh again, just like in verse 1. David begins and ends the psalm with God's name because he is the perfect shepherd. In our last few minutes together, I want to point out a couple of things about the structure of Psalm 23 and how it fits in the Psalter, because it highlights aspects of the psalm even more. Psalm 23 fits within a larger set of psalms that form a chiasm. Chiasm is a form of inverted parallelism in which words or ideas are presented in a particular order, and then they're presented again, but in reverse order. The Bible has a number of examples of using chiastic structure, and it helps us to see relationships between larger chunks of the biblical text. And the whole structure pivots on the center of the chiasm, which draws attention to it. So from Psalm 15 to Psalm 24, we see a chiastic structure. Psalm 15 is an entrance liturgy. Psalm 16 is a song of trust. Psalm 17 is a prayer for help. Psalm 18 is a royal psalm. The middle of the chiasm is Psalm 19, which addresses creation and the Torah. Then we go through the same sequence of topics: royal psalms, prayer for help, song of trust, and entrance liturgy in reverse order. Psalm 22 is a prayer for help in which the psalmist feels abandoned by God and requests deliverance. The psalm concludes with praise, which leads to Psalm 23 and the metaphor of God as a shepherd who sustains and provides for his sheep. Psalm 23 closes with praise in the more intimate setting of God's house. Psalm 24 begins with the greatness of God and questions who can stand in his holy place. The latter half of the psalm depicts the entrance of the great king. So Psalm 23 helps to facilitate the movement from lament to praise and trust. It serves as the bridge of trust between a sense of abandonment to a sense of communion, of coming home to God's house. We can get even more specific and recognize that there is a connection between Psalm 22, 23, and 24. They form a messianic trilogy. Psalm 22 starts with the famous words that Jesus spoke while he hung on the cross. My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" It is clear that Jesus was beginning to quote this psalm, and his hearers would have recognized it. Other verses that are startling include 7 and 8. "All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, 'He trusted on the Lord that he would deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighted in him.'" The psalm talks about being pierced in the hands and feet and casting lots for the garments. Jesus was taking this psalm and applying it to himself to help his hearers understand how it could be interpreted in light of the suffering Messiah. John 10:11 talks about Jesus as the good shepherd who gives his life for his sheep. It is the agony of Calvary that provided the pathway of blessing to green pastures. And if a person wants the full blessing of Psalm 23, then they must encounter the Good Shepherd of Psalm 22. In the Messianic trilogy, Psalm 23, as the next psalm, describes an ideal and perfect shepherd. And the writer of Hebrews confirms that Jesus fits this description. Chapter 13, verse 20 calls Jesus that great shepherd of the sheep. Psalm 23 reflects Jesus' current shepherding role of caring for us and providing for us. And the third part of the Messianic trilogy comes from Psalm 24, which is full of praise to the coming king. Verses 7 and 8 say, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in." Who is this King of glory? "The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle." Similarly, in Peter's epistle, he connects the glory of the coming shepherd to the blessing of his own. Chapter 5, verse 4 says, "And when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away." So there is a beautiful parallelism between Psalm 22 and Jesus is suffering, Psalm 23, and Jesus as the great shepherd who currently cares and provides for us, and Psalm 24 about the future coming of the shepherd when he will receive the glory due him and his own will be blessed as well. As a good shepherd, Jesus gave himself for us. And for those of us who have encountered the suffering shepherd of Psalm 22 and we have met the Lord at Calvary, we can call him my shepherd. He has become personal to us. He provides rich pastures for our spiritual needs. He helps us to travel right paths, and he protects us in times of danger and distress. And just as David proclaimed in Psalm 23, verse 6, his aspiration that he would dwell in the house of the Lord forever, all of us who claim Jesus as our great shepherd look forward to dwelling eternally with him. Let me conclude by talking about sheep for just a moment, since we relate to the sheep in the psalm. While sheep may seem harmless, they can get into all kinds of trouble. They have a curiosity that can cause them to get into dangerous situations, such as grazing without recognizing that they're on the precipice of a massive cliff. They can be oblivious to their circumstances. Some like to wander and they get lost, and sometimes they lose their lives in the process because they get too far from the shepherd. When sheep are without a shepherd, they're utterly helpless. They're at the mercy of ravenous beasts that want to devour them. Sometimes there are belligerent sheep that cause unrest in the flock. They'll be in a beautiful pasture with abundance all around them and fight over a small tuft of grass. However, other sheep are very tender and sensitive. They nudge their way to the shepherd and stay close to him. And that's the kind of sheep that we need to be. Each one of us needs to push our way and nudge our way to stay close to our shepherd, our pastor, and also to our great shepherd, Jesus. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of All Things Apostolic. And until next time, take care and God bless.